Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Welcome to Coaching Uncaged. Today, I am joined by Andrew Macklin. Now, there's a bit of a story to how Andrew and I arrived in this space, in this conversation. Andrew and I were having a conversation about a developmental course, a new course, Animus, looking at relationship coaching. We've run relationship coaching courses in the past, and we were looking to revive this work. And in our conversation, where we were talking about the things that coaches might need to look out for when they're doing relationship coaching, whether that's with a couple or an individual. And in that conversation, one of the things that sort of came to light was this idea of domestic violence and the statistics around that, which meant that as a coach, especially doing relationship coaching, this is something that might show up in your space. And Andrew and I had a fascinating conversation around this, and I thought it would be really useful and good and healthy to bring that conversation to a wider audience so we can just kind of explore what this might mean or how we might, I guess, navigate this space. So before I sort of continue on with my kind of exploration of it, I'd like to welcome Andrew to the podcast. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Andrew, you are an actor, you're a coach, you're a facilitator, a workshop leader, and you work in the domestic violence space. Mm-hmm. I guess you might say, how might you sort of describe that world from a coach's or coaching perspective?
I guess the work in around domestic violence from a coaching perspective, or the work that I've done, is very much in the group context predominantly. So it's very much around domestic violence prevention. So not working directly with victims, although, you know, as our conversation around the statistics shows, quite often, you know, you may be in groups with victims. So it's very much actually coaching orientated to a degree. It's those group sessions are very much about inquiry, really unpicking for people where they stand in relationships, what their values are within them, and then setting up the idea or the frame of healthy and unhealthy, and then using that as a prism to explore the ways in which relationships can err on either side. And that sort of leads us in then to discussions on unhealthy relationships and the patterns that might begin to originate in that way. So that's how it works from a coaching perspective. Yeah.
And it's really interesting you were saying there about the patterns that might emerge. And I guess as a coach in a coaching session, those patterns might be the thing that you might notice that may cause you to inquire or may cause a red flag, if you will, to kind of come into the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the key element. I mean, a lot of the work, like I said, is around prevention. And the key to that is identifying what these patterns of behavior are. And it's key that it's a pattern as well, because I guess we can get into a conversation and you can begin at the end of the training or conversation to feel like anything I do in a relationship might then equate to abuse. And so the pattern is a very key element to it. And I guess those early warning signs can be a mixture of things that are often quite seen as normal quite often. So it can be to do within relationships around isolation is sort of a key element that might begin. So that could look very natural at the beginning of a relationship. You know, we all have stories or experiences of friends who disappear for 6 months when they meet someone new and, you know, you don't see them. And of course, that might well be, you know, perfectly healthy. On the other side, it could be the beginnings of isolation happening in a relationship. And that's where the pattern begins to come in. So to look at that through the lens of domestic violence and say, you know, I'm not seeing as much of my friend as I used to. They're not coming out to the events that we're inviting them to. And then maybe begin to piece that together with other elements that might be in place. So it might also be that when you do meet them as a couple, maybe the comments being said by the new partner are degrading to some element, or there's a sense of talking the partner down to some degree. They might say in some ways that perhaps some of the behavior that that new partner has might be intimidating. So it might be that they lose their temper quite a lot or get right in the face of the person. So we can begin to look at these things through that lens of domestic violence and begin to piece them together and say, actually, this is more than just one isolated incident. This seems to be a collection of behaviors beginning to form. So I guess when it comes to those early warning signs, it's not to look for one distinct particular one, which is why I won't be giving us a list, although it's a long list. It's very much, I guess, as a coach as well, having the awareness, as I guess we naturally have, to look outside of what our client might be telling us and just have that lens and go, okay, well, I wonder what else I'm noticing within that relationship. And fundamentally, at the core of it, really is an abuse of power within the relationship. So it is one partner choosing to abuse that power. And that's sort of the origins of it, really.
So we can sort of talk about sort of that abuse of power and those sort of things that we might identify, as you were saying there, about unhealthy and healthy relationships or qualities within the relationship. And I guess part of our conversation here is to say to coaches that it's not their job or their place to diagnose this and to say, I have seen this pattern, therefore this is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not the job to look at that. What I would say, I guess a lot of the work in this prevention work, and I work with social workers and teachers and in lots of different areas, and it's really what we need in society are more people to use that lens of domestic violence or to have it as an option. So not to be diagnosing our friends or our client, but to have it there as a way of viewing the world potentially. And in a lot of the work with teachers and social workers, in some environments, the time and space are so short to where they're actually interacting with a victim or survivor of domestic violence, actually there's a lot to try and squeeze in training-wise to go, how do I create a space for this individual to feel like they can disclose? And that's a tricky thing to do in areas of short time and space. And I guess from our conversation, what came out to me and as a coach as well is the fact that, you know, the coaching space is an hour of a very well-held space where the idea is very much to dig into our blocks and domestic violence will begin to come up as a block. And it might not come up in the form of a very direct block of physical abuse. It might well come up as, professional block. So maybe it's someone who's not made it to their latest interview. And maybe you say, well, you know, that was a really important thing. And, you know, why I'm interested to know why that maybe hasn't happened. And that might lead us into, well, actually, you know, my partner didn't want me to do it, felt really strongly that I shouldn't do it, felt so strongly I shouldn't do it that, you know, they took the keys of the car and didn't actually let me go. And so while coaching our clients, it is likely to some degree that we might come across this. And I say likely only because, you know, the statistics show that one in three women in the UK will experience abuse at some point in their lifetime in a relationship. So, I mean, with that as a statistic, I think we get an idea of the societal prevalence of it. Mm. It doesn't feel that common because we don't hear it on the news as much, obviously. But from my work, and I would say a lot of the work that I would do as well is around groups of young people. 16 to 25 is the most at-risk age group, which is often startling for some people, but it's in those conversations I've had in groups, the attitudes and myths are very much in place that breed this. So yeah, I think it is going to come up in some way. And I think for me, at least, what's I think most important for coaches to realize, not to have to diagnose what's happening, but just to have maybe perhaps the awareness of what it could be, to be able to recognize it and maybe then bring that awareness to a client and say, well, I'm noticing these different elements. What's your sense of that? And where might your relationship be, or this element of the relationship on that spectrum of healthy to unhealthy? Mm-hmm. And then of course it's, you know, it's very much about referring that client on then to the appropriate help.
I guess that, you know, often as coaches, we're delving into all sorts of things. And because of that delving, I guess, and the space that we hold, so we hold this incredibly safe space, this secure space, this held space. And we're asking all of these questions. Our clients are, you know, they've come because they know we're going to be asking questions and exploring stuff. So I guess that idea of disclosure is more heightened within the coaching space as well. And excuse me. And I think that, you know, often as coaches, we explore what do we do with disclosure, but not necessarily around a domestic violence piece, but just about when somebody gives us some information that we need to refer somewhere else, what do we do with that? And we can be very very knowledgeable about what we might do with a young person in a school that discloses something. But within a coaching environment, I think sometimes we're a little bit less aware of what are the rules or the best practices within in such a space.
Yeah, it is an important question. I think if as coaches we want to be dealing with this when it comes up in the space with a sense of confidence, I think it is important to consider that. And I guess the reassuring thing for coaches, unlike other people that I might train in different areas, is that coaches, you know, the training that we have and the core competencies that are in place are the foundations for taking on disclosure in the safest way. So quite often working with people maybe who aren't familiar with coaching or with how we might deal with disclosures, that the typical mistakes are to jump in with what you think that person should do, or to jump in with, well, let me talk to that partner. So very much directed. And so I guess when it comes to dealing with disclosures as a coach, it's to relax into the fact that your training will do all that is needed. So really what we need to do is create that space as we would. It's really important that how we're working with the client is obviously non-judgmental, key, non-directive as well. I mean, one of the aspects of a domestic violence relationship is that the person who's controlling their partner will be very much dictating what they should do, what the rules are consistently for quite some time. And so if we were to come in a directive way for the victim, that feels very much like yet another person telling me what I should do. So robbing that person of self-agency. So we really actually just want to create the space for that person just to come to their own conclusions around that. And then I would say, if we notice it, if we are concerned or worried, it's very much then about, I'd say two things. I'd say one, it's about talking of relationships as in that spectrum of healthy to unhealthy. Quite often the difficulty can be, well, something is wrong with me if I'm in an abusive or unhealthy relationship. Mm-hmm. So talking about it from that frame of healthy to unhealthy would be one key aspect. And the second then is, if we are concerned, it's very much about offering pathways to support for our client, whether that be through the National Domestic Abuse Helpline or through Refrage or through counseling. But that bit is key. It can become, obviously, as we know, quite a dangerous thing. So yeah, they need to find the correct support.
And one of the things you said there kind of hinted towards not being the authority in the space. And it reminded me of working with young people and how young people are so used to everybody else having or being authority around them or having that over them, that when we go into work with young people as coaches, we can spend a lot of time having to de-authorize ourselves, if that's the right word. And I guess that's the same here, that, you know, in a coaching space, we talk about not being the authority, not being the knowledge, but being the frame holder and the question asker, the challenger. And I guess we're doing the same thing here. We're going, okay, let me ask the questions to understand and to reflect my understanding, to highlight something. And then if we find something in that we go, okay, something isn't quite right there, mm-hmm. we then seek out the right person to then have that conversation with or to explore that with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd say it's even more crucial, I guess, when it comes to domestic violence, because the experience of the victim will very much, or survivor, depends on the terms that people feel more comfortable with, but they will be, like I said, very consciously isolated. Very consciously, their sense of autonomy will be robbed and slowly taken away. So the very fact they're in a space where they're being asked what they think can be so crucial to those that client then taking their next step. So really, in a sense, as coaches, you know, there's so little that we need to do, because finding a space like a coaching space as a victim of domestic violence is, it's so, I'd use the term revolutionary, because predominantly in finding, trying to seek the right support, I think there's a statistic that says, I think 85% of victims have made 5 attempts to find support in the year before they actually get it, which, to break that down, means there's been roughly 5 times they've gone to a professional and or friend or colleague and have either been dismissed, not listened to fully, maybe not taken seriously. And we know that those things are not going to happen in a coaching space. So it's quite a unique place. So I would say with that, it's very much around a coach actually taking a step back and just asking those questions and allowing that client to come to those realizations that actually, yeah, other parts of my life are being affected by what's going on. That although maybe trust has been presented to me by my partner as being a crucial thing, the way in which it's being used in this relationship is actually quite controlling. Mm. So those realizations come, then, you know, the client begins to get that sense of, well, actually, there's more I can do here. Very consciously as well, the perspectives of a victim will be distorted by the perpetrator as well. So the goalposts will be removed around what good, healthy relationships are and what they aren't. So, yeah, just having a space to be able to reform for themselves what is appropriate within relationships, that is crucial in and of itself.
And when you were talking there about this, you know, 5 times somebody may have sought help or began to speak about this but not be fully heard, it reminded me of what you said earlier about these myths that are created around this and how we may, as not necessarily as coaches but as people, be responding to the myth and not doing the hearing. And I just wondered if you could talk about the myths a little bit.
Yeah, great conversation to have, because they're very much in society and they're very much societal norms. So the myths, we may, I guess the crucial thing is not to play into those myths ourselves as coaches and just as people in the world. They're, like I said, very much a part of our society. The predominant one, the key one, would be clearly identified under victim blaming. So that sense of, and this is something I hear in every training at some point, usually with younger people, less with old, but, you know, she was deserving of the behavior. And I'm using the dynamic, the gendered approach of men to women here, only because the statistics show that 85% of the time it is abuse from men towards women. Of course, it happens the way around as well. But the myth there that there is something that the victim has done that has justified the abuse to some degree. So quite often a question that will come to a victim will be, if they are being abused, that might not be physically, it might be psychologically or emotionally as well. The question would be, well, you know, what have you done to maybe upset your partner that you know, instigated this behavior? And it's very much to come again at the idea that actually, where am I placing the responsibility for this behavior? And it's not on the victim. If someone's choosing to be abusive, it is a choice. Some other, I guess, common myths that are used quite often in to excuse domestic violence would be the learned behavior argument, which is a tricky one. So the idea that I may have grown up in an abusive environment and therefore my behavior is dictated by that experience. Now, this can be tricky because obviously our backgrounds play into how we are as people. But we know from the evidence that there are, you know, thousands of people who have grown up in environments of abuse who then gone on not to be abusive. But it can be used as an excuse by a perpetrator, and it can also be used as a way for us to excuse the behavior. That person is behaving in that way because they don't have alternatives. And one of the key ways in which, and I'm, like I said, you know, it becomes harder for those people to make the right decision, but not impossible. And I think a key thing as well, as a lens to use for all of this when it comes to these myths, is that domestic violence is directional abuse. So it is very much aimed at one individual and one individual alone. So a lot of the arguments of, well, you know, I just lost my head, I had to lash out. You know, who are you lashing out to and when? Is it the one person who you already have a lot of control over in behind closed doors when there's no accountability? Because if it's true that you just, you know, lose yourself and you get emotional or angry, then are you lashing out at the person in Tesco if they've gotten your change wrong? Are you lashing out in other public environments? And with domestic violence, we see that that's not happening. So there's very conscious decisions being made continuously to avoid accountability and create situations where they can be abusive without any accountability. So I'd say victim blaming and those learned behavior arguments and that male excusing, to use a term, or perpetrator excusing of, you know, it's because I love you so much, actually. It's very heightened emotions within the relationship. And that's why sometimes I overstep the mark. And actually there's choice. There's choice in that. So it's always coming back to that sense of choice and responsibility. And if is someone completely absolving themselves of all of it? And there can be very cunning excuses as to why they might go about doing that. But I think those are some of the key myths that come up again and again.
So I might be listening to this conversation as a new coach and go, wow, that sounds like a really tricky space to be in. Maybe I won't do this coaching thing. Maybe I'll step away from that. It's a little bit like when, you know, we have the conversation about might somebody need therapy as opposed to coaching, and people get caught up in this, you know, am I re-triggering trauma in my coachee through the language that I'm using? So this desire to step away from working with people as opposed to stepping in or leaning in and exploring this work. And I guess this is a roundabout way of me kind of going, what might you say to people who are having that sort of that concern or that doubt about this work, or about, I guess, their ability to sit in this space, or a fearfulness about this space?
Yeah, I'd say two things on that. I'd say on two levels, on a societal level and an individual coach level. On a societal level, we need to step in. So what we don't need as a society is to put our hands up and say, I don't want to get involved in this. I'm a little bit worried. So let's not do anything about this. As a society, we need to be in a place where we can identify exactly what's going on and be willing to step up in the right ways and say, I'm worried, I'm concerned. This is what I see happening. How can I be of help here? So as a society, that's what we need. And coaches, I think, can play a part, a key part in that. On an individual coach level, I would say it is very much down to your own level of comfort with this. Anyone coming to this kind of material might have their own experiences going on. They might have their own comfort level within it. And of course, we're not asking anyone to step over that within a coaching context. So if it's something that you feel, you know, I don't feel comfortable in any way, shape, or form having a conversation on these lines with the client, then absolutely, that's fine. What I would say is that, you know, if it's a concern for you, the very least maybe would be just to say, look, I'm a little worried, or however you want to phrase it, and have you, you know, considered these other references for support? But I would say that there are so few spaces. And coaches are already, I think, so well trained with this. I mean, I was talking with a colleague of mine who is a lecturer in understanding domestic violence and abuse. And the point she made wonderfully was that, you know, we need people who have the skills to listen actively and know how to create the space and know how to be non-directive and non-judgmental. We need people like those, more of them in the world, to be responding to this. And so I guess then, as coaches, I guess what I would say is trust in your own ability and trust in those core skills and those core competencies of being non-judgmental, non-directive, key. And yet to trust in that and know that actually in giving that space alone, what you're doing, because that space won't be present in any other area, especially the further on the relationship goes. So that space alone is so crucial that if that's all that you feel you can offer, then absolutely, that's fine. And then in the context, I guess, of, because I think it can be an interesting question was put to me by a coach around, well, what if my client is getting support already from the frontline service? Where's my role within that? And I would say to that, really, it's about making a clear boundary distinction between the two types of work that's happening, agreeing not to coach around the domestic violence, because that's not our speciality, But there's a crucial role to play around how we begin to bring back that sense of agency and confidence for an individual, because those will be so strategically robbed by a perpetrator over time that I think there's a role of support there as well.
That's really great. So as I'm listening to that, I sort of think that as a coach, you can find your space within this area if this area presents itself within your coaching. But also there's some real sort of something to hold on to, a frame, I guess, that if you start to notice this, that there are other support agencies that you can lean into, as well as, I suppose, getting your own supervision. Because I guess sometimes as a coach, we might not notice that this is taking place, or we might not notice the patterns, but in supervision, that can be highlighted to us, mm-hmm. which kind of calls for coaches having supervision in this as well. And I guess that's part of the whole, how do we safeguard ourselves and others, is by making sure that we're getting supervision.
And I'd add to that as well, I guess the pressure can come quite often, and certainly it was there for me when I first started to work in this area of, how do I solve this problem for this individual if I were to come across it? And it's to shift that into, I'm not solving it. It doesn't end with me. I'm simply one piece in this puzzle. So we're very much trying to create a pathway. So for a coach, it's not about, well, how do I manage and deal with this in the space and cure it or solve it? It's very much around, what is my piece in this puzzle? And that piece might just be the listening and the referring on, or the offering of a card with a domestic violence helpline on it. That might just be your piece in the puzzle. But I think to note with that most victims of domestic violence are so unlikely to come across someone with the skills of a coach when it comes to that listening, that really you should sit and rest in that it's I think it's a really crucial space, because like I said, the vast majority of times when someone will go to someone, they're not going to necessarily get the best advice straight off.
And something there you said reminded me of something I thought about earlier was, you said that the solving, and that reminded me of the rescuer, and you talked about the perpetrator earlier, and it kind of like this, there's this drama triangle that can exist, or that we can become part of if mm-hmm. if we seek to solve. Mm-hmm. So making sure that we're staying in that adult space and we're staying in that reflective space, as opposed to going, let me fix this for mm-hmm. them. Because as coaches, we don't do the fixing, but I guess that when this is in the space, there may be an emotional side of us that's triggered, mm-hmm. and we can cast off our training and go, but I just want to help, mm-hmm. and sort of dive in there. And it's kind of remembering that the help is to not try and solve, but remember that you are part of a bigger jigsaw that comes together.
Yeah, that is crucial. It's crucial. And that resonates completely with me when receiving disclosures, that sense of a very emotional, what do I deal with this, and how do I help this person? And it really is crucial to step out of it, because domestic violence works in a particularly counterintuitive way. So quite often the natural instincts we have as humans as to what we think will be the of most use actually work in the opposite ways. So quite often there can be a sense of, well, I might need to rush to get this person out of that situation. That's the thing that needs to happen. And actually, we know that, you know, abuse is likely to heighten at that point. So it works in very counterintuitive ways, which is why it's really in the hands of professionals to deal with that. But I think within that, like I said, with that drama triangle, it's consciously making sure that we stay in that coaching space and relying on our own skills that we have and that training.
I remember talking to you before we started recording around the sort of, anxiety is the wrong word, but my own sort of concern about bringing this conversation into the space, and I guess a fear of getting things wrong or upsetting people unintentionally. Mm-hmm. And as we're having this conversation, I'm sort of shifting into a different way of thinking or feeling about it, as, you know, perhaps it is about leaning in and having those awkward conversations with ourselves and with our colleagues to find the language to be okay to have these conversations.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Like I said, Yeah, it's that very much, and I would have had it the same myself, that sense of putting your foot in it continually. When I started training around, well, the ways in which I found ways of explaining these ideas, you could put your foot in it continually. And I think if that's becoming a sense of us wanting to step away from it as a conversation and not, yeah, like you said, have a conversation with colleagues around it, then I think that's something to be checked. And going, well, what's of more importance here? And for me, it's very much around, well, you know, are we getting to the root of domestic violence and how we can support that, how we can support people out of that? And then the mistakes that I might make naturally when training, and I'm sure even in this conversation, they come at a slightly different level for me. So, and also, you know, having conversations off that, of course, and it's something that's happening continually in the domestic violence world as well around, well, what are the terms that we need to use and how might they need to be changed? I mean, you've noticed myself flickering between victim and survivor and perpetrator and male excusing. Some of these terms are gendered, some are not. And of course, depending on who we're talking to and the context they're coming from, we might need to adapt that language because, yeah, we'll all feel differently about it. So it's that thing of coming to an agreement, contracting with people as to what we feel most comfortable, the language we feel most comfortable using so that we can have those conversations that are so important.
And you know, as we continue here, I sort of think about the, I don't know if I'd call it a need, but that possibility of training for coaches in this space, so coaches can feel comfortable in this space and feel okay to have these sorts of conversations without seeking them out. Because, you know, once we sort of put these ideas in the space, we start to notice things all around us and we start to go, well, is that happening there? Is that happening there? Is that happening there? And it's like to relax that part of us, I guess, but also, you know, thinking about, well, what might be the training that coaches might need to support them in and around this area, especially when we recognize that the statistics say that it's going to show up in that space at some point over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there is definitely things, I think, for coaches to, awareness is curative. So I think it's really much, really about bringing that awareness to us as coaches. And there are frameworks that we can look at, that we can use with clients that help us identify those patterns. And there are, for us as coaches as well, I think key training that is out there that we can get and can be created and made, that's already running to, you know, so many different other fields and organizations, between teachers, social workers. I work in corporates, law firms and banks. So, you know, this sort of training is very much out in that space already. But there is key training around, well, how do the behaviors originate? How do they develop? What is the intentions behind them aren't as important really for our needs in preventing it. But those, that understanding around how those things operate and begin and what they look like in a real life context. So that as coaches, if we hear one, maybe just our interest, or we might notice it, and then we might notice over the course of sessions many others happening as well. And then we might feel in the position of going, well, actually, I've noticed several of these happening. And you can explore with the client through a model. The Duluth model is one that is quite popularly used, just to explore, well, do you recognize anything else happening within this context? So in the same way that as coaches, we would use other frameworks or models to explore some of that, we're not getting into the coaching space. We're simply saying, here's a psychological framework. Do you recognize anything from this? And yeah, that alone, I think, can create that awareness, which is all that is needed, really, in our piece of the puzzle, I think, as coaches. It's because that, you know, that could go for years in a relationship without someone, because it's very much drip fed over time, you know, the ways in which these things work.
This is a fascinating conversation. And I know that part of our journey with this, as it were, is for Animus to look at recreating our relationship coaching course and looking at bringing in some of this work with Andrew into that, so we can sort of develop what it is that we're presenting and giving people more tools and skills to support their coaching and to support the work that they're doing with their coaches. And I guess as we sort of begin to wrap up, I guess I'm caught between, there's a part of me that's sort of going, I want there to be a happy ending in the conversation or a positive here. But kind of, I guess I have to sit with, sometimes things are just difficult and we have to sit with that difficulty of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, if I would see domestic violence prevention as being very positive, Robert. I would say the positive for me, actually, in running these groups for years, is very much actually around having these conversations with people, actually, or noticing those early warning signs at really early stages for people. So before abuse or control or coercion has even begun. So having the lens and the awareness in place really early on, that if someone's coming to coaching and they've got questions around the relationship, and you happen to notice one or two things, and just bringing that framework up for them as healthy and unhealthy, that alone, I mean, part of what got me into coaching was that experience of people identifying for themselves exactly what was happening and it moving into the unhealthy side in a way they weren't happy with, and then consciously going, oh yeah, I don't need to give my boyfriend anything. I have all the rights I had outside of the relationship within the relationship. So actually, if I want to go out with my friends, I can go out with my friends when I want to. So it's really, I think the positive for me in this is that we are in a position to prevent it from happening as opposed to solving it from happening. And I think that is actually, for me, a really positive and exciting thing to have and to be able to do.
Yeah, and I'm aware that I use clumsy language in that. And I guess the positive for me is that we're having the conversation and we're able to lean into that conversation and allow others to consider these conversations and these trainings for themselves to kind of bring that awareness into the space. Andrew, it's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you. I guess it would be great if you could just let people know sort of where and how to find you, and also just to reshare some of those help spaces that people might lean into or share with others.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, you can probably find me at my website, which is www.andrewmacklin.com. Probably the place to find me there. And then when it comes to, I guess, support services, the predominant one is the National Domestic Abuse Helpline, which is run by Refuge. I'd recommend that as a go-to, as coaches want them to refer. But then within that, it's really important that, I guess, victims or survivors of domestic violence get the appropriate help for their ethnic or minority group as well. So if, you know, if sign language is the way in which you communicate, that service might not be best for you. So do go online and look up alternative services as well. There is a plethora of them available. But yeah, I would say as a first port of call, the National Abuse Helpline run by Refuge.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Andrew. And I look forward to further conversations and the recreation of our relationship coaching program. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robert. Thank you.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.